Mr. Hayward, Reel 6. Now, we were talking about this course you'd done at Bovington, and that was about all you remembered of the course. You said your memories were quite vague about other things concerning the course.
Well, except that I did have a notebook, and that is now with Bovington Tank Museum.
And what would that be?
And I do remember that I did a lot of drawings in it with the torques. All the different kinds of screw threads, for instance, that there were different types of screw threads, like Whitworth and BSF, British Standard Prime, and that we were taught things like that. We were taught also...
So you'd note all these in your notebook?
Yes, they'd be in the notebook.
And drawings?
And we were taught how to sharpen drills, the actual drill that goes in the drill machine. We were taught also how to harden metals by heating them up and then plunging them at a certain point in cold water or even into oil. We were taught things like that. That was all part of the fitting course. That little notebook, it was only a thin exercise book issued by the Army. But it contains all the notes I made during that course. And likewise, the Ewens Motor Course, that was a thicker book, and that's also with Bovington Tank Museum. And they were pretty glad to have these things. So they're probably making use of those. They've got quite a good museum and archives department down there.
Now, the next thing, so you went back from there to Catterick. What were you doing? Would that be just attached to the workshops again at Catterick? This is before your final posting to the 5th and 4th floor?
Yes, officially attached to the workshops. I believe one of the chaps that was floating around with me at Catterick waiting for a course actually came on the course with me. But he wasn't a chap I got on very well with. His name was Murray's. A Scotsman from Glasgow, he was an older chap who was rather, I wouldn't say cocky, but he was always very sure of himself that he knew everything, and I think he'd had some kind of engineering background anyway beforehand, so he had the advantage over some of us, so he wasn't very popular. But anyway, I seem to remember that he came back to Catterick with me, and we both got posted a very short time afterwards. I think once we'd been trained, they didn't waste any time, so it must have been sometime in May. And I went off to the 5th and 4th floor, and thankfully, this chap Murray's didn't come with me, he went somewhere else.
Now, how did you feel when you were posted to the this is the second. 5th and 4th Fire Yeomanry. And you went there in May or June 1942. You're not quite sure from the looks of things.
No, I think I've tried to piece it together from what records I've got. And in the end, I came to the conclusion that I couldn't have been back at Catterick very long. So I reckon it was sometime towards the end of May that I got posted. And the regiment were at Hove and Brighton at the time. And I went down there on my own. There was nobody else with me, which I didn't find very unusual. Although some time later, large contingents of people came in altogether later on in the regiment's history. But I got probably because I was a mechanic. I suppose that was the answer. They didn't have too many mechanics.
Now, what were you posted to?
I was posted to HQ Squadron, 2nd, 5th and 4th Yeomanry, at Hove.
And what was in the HQ Squadron? Was there a fitter's troop or were you the workshops?
Yes.
What was it called? Did you see what I mean?
It was called the workshops, HQ workshops. And I was put in with the rest of the crowd. There weren't too many of them. There was a sergeant in charge, and possibly a corporal, and one or two of ordinary troopers.
And who were, did you remember any of the, you know, how did they receive you into? Because you were to serve with them for a long time, you know. Well, what were your first impressions when you joined them and Hove?
Well, my first impressions of the regiment, those chaps that I met at the time, I thought they were quite a wild crowd. Probably because of the language they used, the accent, the Scottish accent, some of which I couldn't understand at the time. And the frequent swearing that took place.
Take the swearing first. I mean, how bad was it compared to what you were used to? Because you'd been in the army a year or so.
Yes, it was certainly more powerful than the swearing we'd heard at Catterick Camp. And a lot of effing and, you know, being and that sort of thing. But it was the frequency with which the swearing went on that I had to get used to, which I did eventually, though I didn't indulge in it much. I think you were asking how they took me. Well, I think they found me a bit strange at first, another Sassenach, I suppose they would call me. And so it was difficult to integrate at first. I didn't feel part of the family.
Were they mainly Scottish at this time? I mean, because they were diluted, I know. Were part of that dilution with English people, or...
Yes.
Strengthening, or whichever way you want to look at it, with English.
They were mainly Scottish. I would say that certainly in the workshops, apart from one chap, they were certainly all Scottish, and all, I would say, very much in it right from the start. You know, 1939.
And the Scotch accent. Accents were stronger then, and also less exposed to different accents than we are now. Did you really have a problem with it? And were they Fife accents, four-fire accents, or was it Glaswegians and things mixed up?
There was one Glaswegian there. He was the driver of a workshop truck, and his name was Jimmy Milne, M-I-L-N-E. He was from Glasgow, and I got the impression that he, because he wasn't a Fife and four-fire of origin, that he wasn't... He was only sort of suffered rather than accepted, because he was a Glaswegian. I don't think they thought much of Glaswegians. But he actually, because he was not exactly ostracised, but because they suffered him, I found it convenient to go out with him on occasion. But he wasn't really my type. He was a bit of a harum scarum. He liked womanising and... I wasn't sort of ready for that sort of thing then. And so, although I would go along with him, perhaps if it was just to trip off somewhere down to have a drink somewhere at a pub, once he started serving off looking for women and that, I would part company with him then. Because I was more interested in... I was still at the stage where I was young and energetic, and I was more interested in wandering about, looking at things, and seeing things for the first time.
So, how serious was this this divide between the Scots, or even within the Scots? Then? I mean, how did they treat you when you arrived? Were they friendly at all, or were they not friendly?
Some of them were quite friendly, but I think when it came to an issue, they would all sort of support each other and leave you high and dry. Fortunately, that sort of situation didn't often happen. But they sort of realised that they'd got to accept people coming in by posting from elsewhere because of their usefulness in their trades they'd learnt. And it all went to make up the regiment. And this was wartime, of course, so they had to, they couldn't sort of be exclusive.
Who was your sergeant, your MT sergeant?
The workshop sergeant, he was a chap called Findlay.
Is that Dave Findlay?
Dave Findlay, yes.
And what was he like?
He was an older chap who, by the time we got to the Normandy stage, you would almost feel that he should have been left behind, because I think he probably got into his 40s by then. But he was a nice chap. He would swear like the rest of them when the occasion was ripe, but generally speaking, he didn't talk too much, only when it was necessary. He was a fairly quietish chap. Got on with his job. He was a good man at his job. And not a sort of a drill sergeant type. He wasn't a bullying type.
Was he a sympathetic NCO? I mean, would he try and help?
Oh, yes. Yes, he would. Yes, yes. Yes, almost, the other chaps who were much younger almost treated him like a father figure. He had that sort of air about him.
Any other characters within the workshops that you recall? You've got a George Fraser mentioned, didn't you?
Yes, George Fraser was a younger chap who'd been in the regiment since its beginnings, so he must have been older than me. Possibly 1 or 2 years older, and he was an enthusiastic mechanic and knew his job, and he was quite a joker. He was always laughing at something or other. Sadly, he got killed later in the war by a mishap, by the truck he was returning from Lille and taking the wrong turning and running into a pocket of Germans. That was very sad.
Any other characters?
Quite liked him. Going back to Jimmy Milne, the truck driver, the workshop truck driver, he let me drive the Leyland on occasion, and that was one of the older type Leylands with a what they call a magneto ignition. So you had to start the engine by means of the handle, which was permanently fixed to the front of the lorry. And this chap, Jimmy, was so short that he had to carry a wooden box in the back of the truck to stand on to start this thing. And he asked me to have a go at it once, and he said, be prepared for a kick. And of course, it was a very long handle, and when it kicked, it had quite a punch. So you had to grip the handle very tightly, otherwise it could push him under the chin. So he taught me that, and he let me drive it, and that was quite a thrilling experience, because you were sitting up so high, you literally had to climb up into this vehicle, and you could see everything that was going on all around you. Yes, he was quite a lad, was Jimmy, but I think it all hinged on the formation of the LAD, the Light Aid Detachment. Once they became part of the regiment from the relay, I think that sounded the death knell for some of the workshop crew like myself. This is one of the things I would have loved to have found out. Was that the reason that I got, being a newcomer to the workshops, was that the reason that I get shunted out
later on
into the tanks at the workshop?
But that's a fair bit later from this.
Fair bit later.
Yep.
And the same thing with Jimmy Milne. I was surprised to find that when he met his death, he was in a tank. So perhaps like me, being the workshop driver, they had found no need to have a workshop driver anymore at some stage because of the LAD, which crept in later in the war.
Now, what about your officers at this time?
Officers, well, two officers I mostly remember, of course, were the officer in command, Colonel Scott.
What was he like?
Now, Ron Cox and I are both agreed on our impressions of the Colonel. We thought he was very, very conscious of his rank, and he would not mix with anybody below a certain stage. I think probably even the junior officers might have found him a bit offish. he was certainly, I've never known him, never remember him ever speaking to one of the rankers like myself. Possibly you had to go before him if you were on some criminal charge, but I never fortunately had to do that. But the only time I ever saw him, I suppose, was when there was some ceremonial going on. And he was dressed up to the nines with his official outfit. The only other officer I had much.
Was he not popular then?
Some people say he was a good man at his job, and I probably wouldn't quarrel with that. But he was certainly not like Monty, for instance, who would have an occasional word with an ordinary banker. He would probably, wouldn't know him from Adam, but he'd probably make it his business to do that. Whereas Colonel Scott wouldn't do anything like that.
So you wouldn't warm to him from the sound of it?
No. He was definitely a very, very military figure to us, who we all felt wary of him. We wouldn't have liked to have crossed swords with him.
Now, this other officer you remember, who was that?
Oh, that was the officer in charge of our squadron, HQ squadron, Major Grant. And
what was he like?
Well, I think he suffered a bit from the fact that he was getting on in years. He also, I think, had something wrong with one of his legs, so that he tended to, rather than march around, he tended to sort of shuffle around. Not quite shuffle, but I mean, he could march to a certain point, but he always had something funny about him, rather like Morse, you know, on the programmes. He seems to have a gammy leg, doesn't he? He walks almost as if he's dragging one leg. But the Major Grant wasn't quite like that, but he had something, obviously, a deformity of some sort. And he was always, I think, because of his age and his obvious deformity, I think he had a chip on his shoulder, and he, every chance he got to take it out on somebody, would. And so occasionally I would find I was the butt.
Was he a competent officer, would you say? A good administrator for the HQ company?
Yes, I would say that was his main forte, was his administration side. He was a major, and so he probably spent a lot of time in the squadron office supervising the background work.
So what was the composition of the headquarters company then, in outline?
Well, it consisted, it did have, you see, there were three squadrons, A, B and C, plus HQ. Well, HQ squadron had, as far as I recall, four tanks, but mainly vehicles. It was mainly composed of vehicles, the echelons. They tell me that there was such a thing as an A and a B echelon. I'm not quite sure of what the significance of the A and B echelons were.
So the four tanks, would they be a fighting unit, or were they...
They would be a command unit.
A troop, or...?
Yes, you could call it a troop, four, but there would be the commanding officer in one, I expect. And the Major sometimes, Major Grant sometimes appeared in a jeep, and sometimes in another vehicle, in a tank. But...
So there was this troop, and then there was... What else was there in the HQ company?
There would be the what we called the reconnaissance troop, the recce troop, which consisted of, originally it consisted of armoured cars, brand gun carriers at one stage, and then later on they got these honey tanks, like small Shermans.
Well, I know you go to them later, so so there's the... The HQ, there's the tank troop, there's the reconnaissance troop, what else?
The motor vehicles, and then there would be the workshops.
Now, the motor vehicles, how many of them would there be, roughly? Or were they the supply, ammunition supply ones, and things like
ammunition,
that?
Ammunition, petrol, yes. A cook's truck would be a cook's truck.
There'd have to be a fair number of those, would there? Or would there just be one ammunition truck for the whole group?
There certainly wasn't just one ammunition truck. There must have been others. Although, when I asked the chap who used to be the quartermaster sergeant, he's still around in Scotland in Dundee, Wilmot his name is. He was very clued up on the makeup of the echelon and what they did. I mean, for instance, a question I asked him not long ago was, did I, as ammunition truck driver...
We'll come back to that, and also that we'll see him to ourselves, if you see what I mean. So, but as you saw it at the time, would there be one cook's truck, one or two or whatever ammunition trucks?
Well, there wouldn't be more than one ammunition truck attached to HQ squadron, only one. And that would be me, of course, later on.
And then supply trucks?
There would be a supply truck, also a workshop truck.
That would be yours?
At the time I was in the workshops, yes, that would be...
Now, what equipment would be carried with the workshop truck, or I presume everything would have to go in it, would it?
Yes, it would have some kind of lifting tackle in it. I would think it would be what they call shear legs. That would be a tripod. They could put some poles in the back, connect it at the top, and make a tripod, and then put a block and tackle. So they could straddle over a vehicle with this tripod and pull an engine in the field, you see. And so they had that sort of contraption.
What else?
They probably have a mobile forge with them. It would be a metal casing with a blower attached to it. You manually wind a handle and it blow air and, you know, a little fire so you could heat something up if you needed. And that would be pushed in the back of the truck.
What would you use that for? Why would you need that?
They might need to reshape something at some stage, you know. Even at home I've found sometimes I could have done with something like that just to do some simple job like repairing or something.
So just to melt the metal and then reshape it to what you want?
Yes, that's right.
Any other equipment, heavy equipment like that?
There would certainly be heavy tools.
Such a
lot of tools.
What would they be?
Spanners and crowbars. They would probably carry a certain amount of wooden blocks with them for, you know, hoisting things up, jacking it up. All sorts of equipment that would be needed in the field, plus their own personal kit.
Now, what would that be then? I mean, what would you as a... You were a motor mechanic or a fitter. Is there a difference between the two?
Yes, there is, strictly speaking. A fitter would be more of a sort of a boffin in a workshop. A skilled man doing things like I was describing, making things out of metal, shaping things, putting screw threads into things, drilling, shaping, machining. Whereas a motor mechanic would be more of a roving character who would go out and mend things on the spot, provided it was possible to do that, if it was a light enough job.
So you were a motor mechanic at the time?
Yes.
Although you'd done a fitter's course?
Yes.
Now, what would your personal kit be then? You know, your tool. Would you be issued by the army with a tool set, or would you acquire it? Or
no, it would be if you had any tools, it would be a tin box which you would simply take from the workshop truck. If you needed them, you would take a standard set of tools in a box, which should be adequate to repair, say, a motor vehicle that had broken down somewhere.
Now, would that be your set? In other words, would the
no,
the
no, it would be my set. It would belong to the workshop.
And how many would they have of those?
Good question.
Approximately.
I would think they'd probably have three or four at least of those. They'd certainly have an adequate supply.
So it's a tool kit. And what would be in it?
Well, there would be a complete set of spanners. There'd be the ordinary open-ended spanners, there would be ring spanners, there would be box spanners, screwdrivers, things called Stilsons.
Oh, all right.
Well, that was like a a movable spanner, but it had a kind of a spring-loaded jaw on it, so that you could grip. If you had a problem getting a nut off, which had got burred over at the edges, you could put a Stilson on it and still manage to turn it off. With that, they were handy tools, and because sometimes even a movable spanner you couldn't get it quite right to get this awkward nut off. Yes, you'd have other things like oil cans to assist you in easing things, perhaps spare bits of wire for electric troubles, any amount of different sizes of screwdrivers, hammers of course, and then you'd have the usual copper hammer so that you could hit things but not make a mark on it. It would be softer metal, so when you hit something with it, you'd give it a good clout, but it wouldn't damage it, like an ordinary hammer. And even a wooden hammer, a mallet, you see, for certain jobs.
And that was all in the toolkit.
Mm.
And actually, we have how many mechanics would there be? I mean, you had a sergeant.
Sergeant?
You wouldn't have. Would there be an officer? An MT officer.
There was an officer, but not particularly in charge of the workshops. I think that might have come under the sphere of the adjutant. He might have been over something else as well.
You didn't have a sort of second lieutenant in charge of the MT, or a lieutenant, just a transport officer?
I don't remember. I certainly don't remember an officer permanently in the workshops. There would be an officer appear occasionally, but I suspect that would be the adjutant or somebody like that.
And you don't remember any particular officer dealing with you at that time?
No.
The only two you remember are Grant and Scott at the time?
Yes. Yes.
What about within the actual workshop? There was Findlay and Milne and Fraser. Anybody else, or how many of you, in other words?
Yes, there was a chap called Christie. I think his name was Alec Christie. He was mainly in charge of what we called the slave. And this slave was really a Brendan carrier with a canvas awning over the top of it to protect a generator. It was equipped with a generator, and the object of that was it could go out to tanks to recharge their batteries. And so that was called the slave, because it had some big electrical, very heavy-duty leads to connect up to the tank from this generator.
And that was Christie's job, Alec
Christie's job. Yes.
Any other specialist equipment or personnel?
No, nothing comes to mind.
Any specialist electricians?
There must have been one, yes. I think of the only other English chap in the workshops. I'm trying to think of his name. Doesn't come to me. It might have been a chap called Bill Tyree. T-Y-R-I-E. Bill Tyree. It might have been him. I suspect he was the electrician.
And what would he deal with?
Ah, yes, well, he would be, as an electrician, he would be capable of not just wiring the jumps and sorting out ignition problems, he would be the sort of chap capable of dismantling a dynamo and rebuilding it, and a magneto, and he'd know all about how to cope with batteries and things like that.
So, whereas you could get a battery going, by attaching a machine, the generator, you wouldn't know what to do if something went wrong.
No, he would know with his equipment whether the battery needed throwing away, or whether it could be revived in some way by changing the acid or something. Similarly, he would know about coils on an engine, and the other electrical equipment. Like condensers, for instance, and cutouts. I think such things as cutouts, which was a gadget to shut off the current coming from the dynamo when the battery had had enough.